Coming down in 3, 2, 1. This is 89.1 WEMU, and I'm David Fair, and on the first Friday of each month, we take on a topic related to the environment in Michigan, and we do so with Lisa Wozniak. Lisa is the executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters and serves as my co-host of WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment. And good to be with you for the September edition, Lisa.
It's good to be here, Dave. Our guest today is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, who is the founder and director of the Michigan State University and Hurley Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative. And she is indeed the person who brought to light the Flint water crisis.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Hanna-Attisha. It's good to have you back on again.
It's great to be here with both of you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you always. And Dave and I have been thinking about you a lot
indeed,
and holding you in our hearts because we heard earlier this year that you had contracted COVID and were recovering. And I know that was a few months ago, but I want to start by asking how you're doing.
Oh, thanks, Lisa and Dave. I'm doing much better. I contracted COVID in mid-March, kind of at the peak of the pandemic. I think it was from an event in New York City, but I have no idea. I had those symptoms that everybody had in the beginning of kind of fever and the aches and chills and obviously lots of fear and anxiety and what's going to happen to me. Fortunately, I recovered really quickly. And the most bizarre thing that happened to me is that I lost my sense of smell and taste for about 2 months. And it's come back, but it's still not 100%. So this virus is bizarre. It impacts folks differently, but it's something that we should continue to take seriously.
Did it happen to spread to the family?
I don't think so. And that's what I was really worried about. My husband is a pretty bad asthmatic, so I was really worried about him. But they seemed okay. And I was, most worried about the kind of older folks. And fortunately, my parents, so my kids' grandparents who are older, their 70s, were not around then, and that was kind of my biggest concern. And also my concern of spreading it to my colleagues. We were still at work then, and to my patients. So I think anybody who kind of comes across this has this tremendous guilt of like, oh my God, did I make other people sick?
Well, I am certainly glad that you are recovering and that it apparently has not spread elsewhere. That is always good news, and we will continue to wish for your continuing recovery and that everything comes back 100%. I do want to talk about the Flint water crisis once again. 2 weeks ago, the state of Michigan announced a $600 million settlement in civil cases filed by residents over the city's water crisis. As the physician who literally helped break the story and call attention to what was going on, no doubt you've been watching these cases closely. Where is the money going, and how does it address the health impacts caused by the crisis?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that we've literally been kind of holding our breath to wait to hear about. When I finally got the news that the settlement happened, I exhaled. Like, it was a literal sigh, like, oh, finally, a bit of justice. And I never used to kind of think about these cases. People would ask me all the time about either the civil cases or the criminal cases or certain investigations, and I would respond like, I'm a doctor. I'm not a prosecutor. That's somebody else's job. My job is the kids. And as this crisis has evolved and as I continue to practice as a pediatrician in Flint, I've realized how important justice is to healing and to health and recovery. Because without any form of justice, the crisis is raw. The trauma is still raw. And we know that can affect people's outcomes, literally their health outcomes. So the settlement is great news. It's definitely a step forward. It's a first step towards justice. It's not the complete step. It's not the end of the story. And my understanding is the settlement for it's a partial settlement and it's a preliminary settlement, so it's not the whole story. It's only the state's settlement. So there's other defendants, including, for example, the EPA and some of the engineering companies, the city. So it's not a complete settlement yet. It's just a partial settlement. It's just the state who has settled. And my understanding is that the majority of the compensation will go to the children, which I think is fantastic. It really kind of respects the science of the crisis, and it respects, who was most impacted by this water crisis. So it's great news. It sounds like a lot of money, but when you divide it by so many people, and when there's also kind of set asides for money going to special education in the schools and for children who don't participate right away. So, it's great news, but it's definitely not the whole story.
What does this mean for the criminal case that the Attorney General's office is working on to hold those responsible for not taking action to address the crisis?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And you know, I didn't really understand the difference in the beginning between the civil cases and the criminal cases. And a lot of folks, when they heard this news, they're like, yeah, but when are people going to go to jail? Like, when are folks going to be held accountable? And that's what the criminal cases hope to deliver. My understanding is that they're still progressing. As you know, when our new governor came in with our new attorney general, they reviewed all the previous criminal cases, and there were about a dozen criminal cases. And they determined that millions of documents were never discovered and devices and what have you. So rather than continue those criminal cases that were already progressing, they dropped all those charges, which made for terrible headlines. And they decided to start those criminal charges all over again. So that's kind of where my understanding is we are with those criminal charges, is that they're still in the period of discovery and will likely, hopefully, bring forth new criminal charges. But I think there's a challenge. They're running against the statute of limitations. I think this is definitely a part of that justice, and that piece of restorative justice is to make sure that accountability happens. And that's the role of the criminal charges.
89.1 WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment continues. I'm David Fair alongside my co-host Lisa Wozniak, Lisa Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, and our guest is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. There is a intersection where the Flint water crisis and COVID-19 and the pandemic meet. Just recently, you were part of a press event urging residents to sign up for the Flint Registry and calling on lawmakers to continue funding for it. What is the Flint Registry, and why is it so important for lawmakers to continue funding it moving forward?
Yeah, thank you for asking me that, Dave. So the Flint Registry is one of the pieces of our recovery, and I would say it's probably one of the most critical ingredients of our recovery in Flint. It is this public health infrastructure that we have built to identify folks that were exposed to our crisis, and more importantly, get them connected to the interventions and the services that we know will improve their outcomes later on in life. So, for example, somebody enrolls in the registry, and then based on that enrollment, we refer them to Medicaid or mental health services or early literacy programs, nutrition services, trauma-informed care, and the list goes on. So it's this public health infrastructure that we have built to be really proactive and preventative to mitigate the impact of the consequences of this crisis. And you mentioned kind of this intersection with COVID, and it's so timely. You know, one of the silver linings of having our previous preventable public health crisis is that we were able to build some of that public health infrastructure to support families and to get them connected to things they need when situations change. So, you know, now this registry, for example, is once again helping families in this second preventable public health crisis and getting families connected to things like healthcare and nutrition and enrichment services for their children, which are the same things that they need now during this COVID pandemic. So this work is long-term work. So that's why it needs to be renewed. If you understand kind of the science of lead exposure and traumas, kids don't just present, acutely with problems. Sometimes it takes, years, if not decades, to manifest. And that's why these kind of supportive interventions like our registry are needed for the long term.
The United States House of Representatives has in its budget proposal agreed to forward fund it for two more years. However, the U.S. Senate has yet to take any action, and it remains unclear as to whether or not that's going to happen. So obviously we'll be watching. But we know that COVID-19 has impacted communities of color disproportionately and communities of lower incomes. Would the Flint Registry be a good model for those kinds of communities across the state and across the country?
This pandemic, just like our water crisis, impacts some communities more than others. So many of the lessons that we learned during the Flint water crisis are now being learned at the national level, lessons in relationship to the importance of of good governance that values public health, how we need to respect science and scientists and doctors, how it's really important to have public health infrastructure built already rather to be proactive and preventative rather than reactive. And I think the most critical lessons that one of the most critical lessons that we learned in Flint that now the nation is learning is this recognition of disparities. And in Flint, this was an environmental injustice that happened in a predominantly poor minority community. And, you know, at first with the pandemic, we were being told that it was the great equalizer. But it's not. Once again, you know, as in most public health disasters, it continues to impact our most vulnerable populations. So there's a lot of lessons that we can learn now at a national scale, things that we have been learning already from our Flint water crisis, how we need to proactively invest in public health infrastructure. And it's not just things like a registry. It's just basic fundamental science-based interventions that we know support individuals and families and communities. Robust funding of public health departments, you know, their respect, leading with science and prevention. Adequate funding for schools and safety net programs so that when schools shut, our biggest concern is not how people are going to eat, but how are we going to educate our children? So we have to do a lot more than we have been doing to respect science, public health, and our most vulnerable populations so that, you know, we don't suffer from similar crises.
Many kids are heading back to school, and some schools are offering in-person school options or could be offering those options in the months and days ahead. We know that lead has been found in the water of school districts across the state, and other problems can happen when water is sitting in pipes for a long period of time, which has been the case during COVID. What needs to happen to make sure that our kids are protected as they head back to school to ensure that they have safe water?
Yeah, Lisa, that's a great question, and I think it's something that a lot of folks haven't been thinking about as we reopen schools, but also reopen lots of buildings that have been closed, including office buildings. Whenever water hasn't been used for a while, it has potential risks and contamination, not just from lead, but also from Legionnaire's disease. So it's really important that for those facilities that are about to reopen, that they consider things like water and air quality, and air quality is also really important during this pandemic, the importance of good ventilation and airflow. There needs to be flushing regimens, filters should be installed, and this should have happened even before we were talking about this. As we know, there's lead kind of ubiquitous in our drinking water infrastructure, and our kids are going to school to learn, not to be exposed to something that makes it harder for them to learn. So this is a great opportunity as we consider these school reopening plans to make sure that when that kid is at the drinking faucet, at that water fountain, that the water that comes out of their tap is lead-free by the installation of filters. That's really the most proactive thing that we can do to make sure that our kids are getting the safest water possible.
Once again, we're talking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisch on WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment. I'm David Fair, alongside my co-host Lisa Wozniak of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters.
So I've been tracking polling over the last 24 months, and what I've seen is really remarkable. Or maybe not surprising, but remarkable. In every single state house district that's a battleground district in this state, the number one issue consistently among all issues, including jobs, the economy, healthcare, you name it, is people's concern about clean, safe drinking water free of toxins. This is no doubt in part because of the horrors of the Flint water disaster, but there are other factors too. And so I wonder from your perspective, how do you see this concern manifesting?
Yeah, that is great news. And I think it also played a part in our 2018 election. Our governor in Michigan, one of the top three items that she ran for was for safe drinking water throughout our state. And it's so ironic, and I think it's important for all of us to take a step back. Like, here we are in Michigan, and I'm literally right now holding my hand up and looking at our mitten state. We are surrounded by the largest source of freshwater in the world. 20% of the freshwater in the world is around our great state, yet we continue to have issues throughout our state, be it lead or PFAS or dioxin, you name it, where we are struggling to deliver safe drinking water. Not only the quality of the water is a concern, but also the affordability of our water. Shutoffs in Detroit and Flint and other communities have really kind of raised the issue that water is a fundamental human right. We have to be able to, and I think the pandemic has made it even more clear. I think the number one recommendation is you need to wash your hands. And for so many of our families, that is a challenge. So I'm reassured. I'm so happy that it continues to poll as an important issue, because it is an important issue. It is important for public health. It's a medical necessity. We have to have safe, affordable drinking water for our communities. So I'm grateful that the politicians are paying attention to that, and I hopefully that when folks are in the position to create policies, that they continue to be supportive of our most preventative, public health-based, science-based policies to ensure that everybody in the state has access to safe, affordable drinking water.
And that brings us to a very important upcoming issue. We can't ignore that there is an important election coming up. What are some of the key issues you are personally watching for from candidates, and what do you most want to see in terms of action on the part of newly elected leaders to better protect the health of communities in our water?
Oh, that is a great question, Dave, and I think this is something that keeps so many of us awake at night, is kind of the state of our nation, where we are in terms of how we care for each other. For me as a pediatrician, as a scientist, how we care about our most vulnerable populations, especially our children, and how we have really abandoned science. So I think there is so much at stake in this election at every level, not just the presidential election, but who we send to Congress, who our local drain commissioner is, who's in charge of our zoning board. Every election is important. And if we want to strive for a place where we don't have to question the quality of the water that comes out our tap, or the education our kids get at school, or the kind of community that we live in that fundamentally takes care of each other and looks out for each other and builds equity, then this is really the most important election, I think, of my lifetime, but I think of really several generations. So there's a lot at stake. You know, if you care for the environment, this is an important election. We are, currently seeing the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency. So we want a new administration in there that will literally have to rebuild the EPA, and hopefully rebuild it with a very much of a prevention focus, rebuild it not listening to the ears of industry kind of lobbyists, which is what's been happening right now, but we'll build it focused on prevention and science. So there is a lot at stake in regards to the environment, but really the direction of this country.
I'd like to thank you so much for the time and for sharing your perspective and opinion. I do appreciate it. And thank you so much for being our guest on First Friday Focus on the Environment.
Thank you. It's been great being with you guys.
That is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. And Dr. Hanna-Attisha is founder and director of the Michigan State University and Hurley's Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative. And it was her research that brought to light the Flint water crisis. And Lisa Wozniak, I look forward to having you back in October.
It's always a pleasure, David.
Lisa Wozniak is the executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters and co-host for WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment. For more information on today's feature and to visit our archive, go to our webpage at WEMU.org. I'm David Fair, and this is 89.1 WEMU-FM and WEMU HD1 Ypsilanti, celebrating 55 years of broadcasting to Washtenaw County and beyond.